Welcome to Elevate, the podcast where trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravapudi talk about the real issues that come with the fight for justice. So let's find inspiration in the wins. Let's learn from the losses. But most of all, let's keep learning and getting better and keep getting back in the ring. Are you ready to elevate your own trial practice, law firm, and life? Let's get started. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Hey, it's Ben. Raul and I started this podcast because we love hanging out with fellow trial lawyers and sharing ideas that can make us all better. And both of our firms also regularly collaborate with other lawyers across the countries in cases where we can add value. If you're interested in collaboration, or even if you just have a case or an idea that you want to bounce off us or brainstorm, Raul and I are going to be hosting confidential case workshops the first Wednesday of each month. So here's how it works. If you have a case or an idea that you want to talk about or brainstorm with us, just send me an email to ben@elevate.net, E-L-A-W-V-A-T-E.net, or go online to elevate.net and submit a case workshop request. We will schedule you for a confidential 30-minute Zoom meeting where we can talk about your case to see if we can help. If you feel like there would be good value in collaborating on the case further, we can talk about that. If not, that's okay too. We enjoy helping other trial lawyers because we know someday you'd be willing to do the same for us if we needed your help. So again, if you're interested in workshopping your case with us, just send an email to ben@elevate.net or fill out a case workshop request at elevate.net, and Rahul and I will look forward to chatting with you soon. Today's episode of the Elevate podcast is brought to you by Filevine. Filevine has a software program called Lead Docket, which is the gold standard for managing your new case intakes and leads, your Glengarry leads, your Glenn Gross leads, and all of your other leads. So check them out at Filevine and manage your leads. We're also brought to you by Steno. Rahul, you guys work with Steno.
Steno is the best in court reporting services, not just in court reporting services, but even some of their technology tools. We're talking about AI a little bit on this podcast and their transcript genius, where they can summarize and take interrogatories based on deposition transcripts, is so useful. If you haven't tried it, definitely try it.
We're brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal does digital marketing, web development for trial firms. It's owned by our good friends, Micah and Tyler. They recently redeveloped our firm's website, so you can check our website out. If you like it, give them a call and they can help you out too. And finally, we're brought to you by Expert Institute. Rahul, you guys work with them, right?
We both use Expert Institute because you always need to be cutting edge in the experts that we use in our cases. Going to the repeat experts every single time is going to make you a lesser lawyer, and you always want to keep up, and the best way to do that is with Expert Institute.
For more than 4 years, you've helped us elevate the practice of law. Now, we're ready to take on the business of law. Say hello to the new podcast from the Elevate team. Build and grow your law firm. Enjoy this special preview episode.
Welcome to the Elevate Build and Grow Your Law Firm podcast. I'm Jeff Wright, Chief Operating Officer at Gideon Aisen, and our host, Ben Gideon, owner and partner. Good morning,
hey, Jeff.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Looks like you're waking up, although I know you've been up for hours.
Yeah, I've been up for about 5 or 6 hours so far. We got a lot going on this week and next week, so making time for everything, as you know.
So tomorrow is our quarterly planning meeting. Looking forward to that.
I am. I mean, for those that haven't tuned in on any of the earlier ones, we kind of launched our strategic plan this past January, so we're starting Q3 of it, and we'll cover what we accomplished and what we didn't for Q2. And set new goals for Q3, but I'm very excited for it. It's a half day well spent.
Yeah, I agree. I always look forward to it because it's time out of a busy schedule where you can just reflect and focus on big issues and do it with really smart people that are part of our leadership team. So I find it quite enjoyable, a nice break.
Yeah, I think it's invaluable having the third party to help us navigate it as well. Trying to do it ourselves without a third party holding us accountable would be a challenge.
Yeah, it's worked well. And we've invited Melissa Shanahan, who has the firm called Velocity Works that we work with, to come on the podcast. And hopefully we'll find a time to talk to her soon.
Yeah, I think they'll enjoy her. We have a lot to cover today. Mm-hmm. So really, we've kind of laid the groundwork. And today, we want to go through the process of leaving a law firm to go out on your own, the decisions that are made in that, how to choose your partner or partners wisely, and how to staff up. Because for all intents and purposes, you're a startup and you're really starting from bare bones and losing all the infrastructure that maybe you took for granted in the past. So let's start with leaving the law firm.
Yeah, let's do it. So we're now at the point we've talked about in the last couple of shows where you make a decision about whether you want to go out and start a firm and what goes into that. But you've made the decision, you're going to launch a law firm. And for many people, that involves leaving wherever they're currently practicing. For me, it meant leaving a law firm where I was an owner and a partner and a member of the leadership team for almost 2 decades. I was there for 17 years. So most of my adult portion of my career was spent there. And anybody who tells you that that's an easy process is lying to you. I have spoken to so many lawyers. I reached out to a lot of my lawyer friends who had started their own firms to get their advice. Many of them said, don't do it. Many of them said, it's the best thing I've ever done. So there was a wide range of perspectives. But what everybody told me was how difficult it is to leave a law firm. And many of them, and folks that I really trust and respect and know to be really great people, ended up in litigation with their prior firms. So I almost think that it's the norm rather than the exception that leaving a law firm it can be very bitter and very divisive. And part of that is that there's so many entanglements. There's the professional entanglements, but there's also the personal side. And these are people that, like most lawyers, you're spending most of your waking hours, most days of the year at work. These are your closest confidants. They're some of your closest friends. They're people you may socialize with and do lots of other things outside of the workplace with, in addition to your livelihood, your whole business and career tied up in. So there's a lot of different layers of entanglement. And we were talking about it before we went on air, Jeff, and the best analogy I could come up with was that it's like a divorce where you may have been married for many years, because there's so many things to disentangle depending on how long you've been together and whether you have kids or you want to own property or real estate together. And that led to the great insight that one Jeff Wright, one chief operating officer at Gideon Asen, has been twice divorced. So who more of an authority to talk about the issue of extricating themselves from a relationship at like a divorce than Jeff Wright? Good. Jeff?
No.
The floor is yours.
This is the time of the show where we air my dirty laundry. I appreciate that.
I did want to say to the listeners, I got your permission to ask you about this because I didn't want to put you on the spot.
No.
And you said it was okay.
So. Yeah, completely comfortable conversation, man. No, after you were explaining to me kind of the process, I think your divorce analogy is perfect. I mean, first of all, in the decision to get a divorce, you're leaving something that at one point was very comfortable. You're leaving something at one point or that is very familiar for the unknown. Same exact thing when you're leaving a firm. It's very emotional and for a variety of reasons. And then you hit on, is it an amicable separation or not so? You could wind up in litigation. You could wind up in divorce mediation for a number of years if it's not amicable. And then really, at the end of the day, you have to be able to separate the emotion to a certain extent because it does turn into a business transaction. I'm sure you'll get into it, but you had cases that you were working on. You had clients that probably wanted to stay with you. And the logistics of that, it's no different than having kids, having a house, having 401ks and vehicles. And how is all that going to be split amicably? And can you come to an agreement that everyone's happy with? So as happy as I am to talk about my past failures, I think your analogy is spot on.
Yeah. And I think one thing to recognize is that a decision to leave may not necessarily be correctly characterized as a failure. It may be that it was better for both sides, or it was a smart decision for you. And so, you know, and that, I think that can be the true of leaving a law firm as well, that there's a way in which both sides can go on and thrive and maybe even do better than they did before, even though it's hard to see that at that very moment that the separation occurs. Yeah. So I'm going to tell you just a few takeaways that I have that maybe will help others that are going through that process of leaving a law firm to start a new practice. One of the principles I tried to follow was to think about kind of short-term goals and long-term goals. And in the short term, the number one most important thing for me was to be able to make the transition as smoothly as possible, to get my new firm up and running, and to be able to quickly generate a revenue stream that will allow me to meet my financial obligations and build the practice. And in order to do that, I knew I was going to have to devote 100% of my time and energy to building the new business. And I did not want to have any of that siphoned off or drained by friction with the old law firm. So minimizing that friction was very high on my priority list. And it was higher than the goal of winning every little battle or every little fight with the law firm. And so part of that is it's important to take the ego and emotion out of it, because if you get dragged into petty battles, it's easy for those to blow up into bigger issues. And that starts to drain your energy level, create additional source of stress and distraction from what you really need to be focused on, which is building your new firm. So one way we did that was we hired a lawyer to help us navigate the process, and then for the most part, let him handle everything. And he was a lawyer that we had specifically chosen because he's a low drama guy. He doesn't want to incite battles or to ratchet things up. He viewed his role as to try to tamp down any kind of emotion and to just turn it into a transaction that compromise that could work and make it as seamless as possible. So by hiring him, taking ourselves out as the primary points of contact and getting someone in place that had that objective, that really helped us a lot. In the long term, what I was hoping is that although I knew it would be painful and there would be some anger and resentment short term with my prior firm, I was hoping in the long term to be able to preserve my reputation in the community and also some of my relationships with the lawyers there, so that, you know, we would continue to be able to have a working relationship going forward. And that's really borne out. We're now co-counseling a very significant case together. And so although it took a couple years to get to a point where we could get back to working well together, we have gotten there. And I think one reason we were able to is because we did not create additional fights. We did not get into petty squabbles about minor issues. So that I would really highly encourage people don't take the bait. Don't let your ego get in the way. Do try to, at all costs, to avoid litigation, avoid acrimonious fights. And part of that is, if that means taking a little less than you might think you deserve, just take a little bit less, walk away, because you're going to make that up multiple times over by reserving that energy for your new practice. It just really isn't worth it. So
what was the ballpark time frame from when you obviously spoke to the other partners and let them know your intentions to having a clean break the attorney that you hired working everything out? Are you talking weeks? Are you talking months?
Yeah, it was, as I recall, it was a couple months. And we quickly moved to having a transition plan, which, you know, and to the credit of my former firm and the managing partner there, who I considered a friend then and I still consider a friend now, he's a very, first of all, very smart managing partner and a very good business person who does a great job managing that firm. And I think he saw it the same way I did. And although it was not amicable in the sense that everybody was happy about it, he worked really well together with us to create a plan that was reasonable. I mean, they didn't try to extract more out of us either than they could. And what we did was we came up with a game plan for cases that we would be taking with us, because the presumption was that my clients that I had developed a relationship with were going to want to most likely continue to have me as their lawyer. So rather than having that process where people are reaching out to clients and trying to solicit clients on one side or the other, bad mouthing people, trying to undermine, we avoided all of that by just agreeing that certain cases would come with us and certain cases would stay with my former firm. And then for each case that came with us, we had a breakdown of what the fee share would be. And that depended on how many years that case had been worked on at my former firm, sort of how much time and money that firm had invested in that case. So, I mean, if that case was toward the tail end and most of the work had been done under that firm, they would get the lion's share of the fee. And over the next couple of years, as those cases resolved, we sent, I mean, I want to say at least a couple million dollars in referral fees back to my former firm. So that was not a bad deal for them, because these were cases they had no further responsibility for managing, and they were getting paid handsomely on those cases. We were 100% reliable in terms of if we promised to pay them a fee, we paid them every penny of the fee. We didn't mess around with it. We wanted to be good to our word. You know, we did a good job of monetizing, I think, every single case that came with us. There were about 40 cases we settled in the course of about a year and a half, 2 years, and paid every penny of what was owed back to my former firm. So I felt pretty good about that. But at the same time, that gave us 40 cases that we wouldn't have had if we were just starting from scratch. And that funded our firm for the first 2 years, approximately. So it was a real win-win, I think, for both sides. And instead of being a really ugly situation, I think both sides were able to gain something from that. So that worked out really well, having a very clear plan, every single case listed on the plan. By the time we left, we knew exactly what the fee breakdown was, and we honored that. The clearer the rules of engagement are, the better it's going to be going forward, because then you don't have ambiguity, and there's nothing left to chance there. You're just following the game plan that you came up with. I will say, you know, it's many of those cases already had referring attorneys that we owed money to. And of course, part of the deal was we agreed that we would pay the original referring attorney 100% of what they would have been paid without the breakup. So the referring lawyers did not suffer as a result of the change. But when you look at a case and you're paying the referring attorney and then you're paying substantial percentage of the fees back to a second law firm, we were very happy to see the end of that come, because a very large portion of the fee in every case was not kept for us. But enough of it was that it allowed us to fund our practice in addition to the new cases we were acquiring over that period of time to make it work.
Were the conversations with your clients, any of them difficult? Were you questioned as to why you were leaving, and was there something wrong with your firm? Obviously, the last thing you wanted to do was badmouth a firm you're leaving, but it's natural human instinct to think something's amiss if you're leaving. How did you handle that?
So basically, we had an agreement with my former firm that on a certain date that we'd be allowed to reach out and contact clients. We honored that. We did not tell anybody about our separation until the date. And on that date, my partner and I immediately called every client. We wanted them to hear from us first, sort of a, you know, the Jerry Maguire moment, I guess. But some people won't get the reference. I don't know if you do, Jeff, but
I get
it. You know, when he left the firm, they were trying to corral their clients, but it wasn't, there wasn't a lot of pressure because we already had an agreement as to how the, but the agreement was subject to the approval of the clients. So each client had to receive a written, they had to approve in writing the game plan. So we wanted to reach out and we did that. There was not a single client who had any issue with it at all. They were happy to know that I would continue to be their lawyer, or in the case of my partner's clients, Taylor would continue to be their lawyer. Our former firm was really organized in a way that there were different practice groups. And so the relationship with the client was with the lawyers and their team. It wasn't sort of with the firm as a whole. The only people they knew in the firm for the most part were us anyway. So it wasn't, there was no hard sell needed there. So that worked out quite well. But one thing I wanted to mention to our listeners is that actually created a very good lesson for me when we started our own firm. And that lesson is, as a firm owner, especially in a, I think it probably applies to any law firm setting, but particularly in a plaintiff's practice like we have, where some of the individual cases can be extremely valuable. You know, we're talking tens of millions of dollars in case recovery, translating into millions of dollars in fees in single cases. It's extremely important to have a clear contract with your attorneys so that you don't get into the situation of losing valuable case assets if one of your attorneys decides they want to leave and try to take cases with them. Our former firm did not have a good contract. It was very poorly drafted. It didn't really give them any leverage or any rights. And that was very good for us when we left, because they didn't really have anything they could use to protect the firm's assets against us leaving with all of our cases. But we've fixed that mistake in our practice. We have a very strong contract that would make it really difficult for lawyers in our firm to leave and try to, you know, in my mind, steal cases away from our firm. And when you own a firm, you recognize that cases are the most valuable asset you have in your practice, your clients and your cases. And as a firm owner, you invest enormous amounts of time, energy, and money to acquire those cases. And those are firm assets. They're business assets. And we also pay our lawyers extremely well and bonus them extremely well. So I feel that as a consequence of that, we deserve to own and protect those assets. And we will do that. I mean, if lawyers, at the end of the day, lawyers are hamstrung by the ethics rule that says that a client ultimately gets to choose who they want to have represent them. So if one of our lawyers were to leave and a client decided that they wanted to have that lawyer represent them and not have our firm represent them, the client has that, ultimately has that right. And we can't contract around that. But what we can do is say, under those circumstances, you would be paying back all of the costs we've invested. Under those circumstances, you would be paying us a share of the fee. And the fee share we put into the contract is quite significant. So there's not a huge incentive for a lawyer to leave our practice and try to take a case with them, because they would have to pay a lot of that money if they were to recover it back to us anyway. And I think any law firm would be making a big mistake if they don't have really solid contracts with all of their attorneys to protect them against that situation. So that's one thing I've learned.
Yeah. Ben, just to be conscious of kind of our time before we move on to talking about, do you want to leave with a partner? Do you want to have partners? How you made that decision? Hindsight's 2020. Were there any mistakes or things that you would have done different? Or
yeah, I'll just touch on a couple, and I know we should move on to the next topic. But one of the mistakes I made was I went to all of my staff, and I had a very great support staff at my old firm, paralegal who had been with me for all of the 17 years I had been there, a second paralegal who I had recruited and was fantastic. and a really top-notch legal assistant. I had advised them of my plans to leave and asked each of them, you know, what their interest would be in coming with. And at least two of the three told me in really no uncertain terms that they were all in. They wanted to come with me. They thanked me for, you know, making that opportunity available. And so my full expectation was I was going to be bringing most of my team intact with me to my new practice. Well, what happened was, so first of all, when I told the managing partner at the prior firm, probably quite smartly, within about an hour of me telling them, they reached out to all of my staff there and they basically said, you're either going with Ben, or in which case you're fired immediately, or you need to commit right now that you're staying. And keep in mind, these are people that had a steady, dependable job, source of income, good benefits at a firm that gave them a lot of job security that they had been with for, in most cases, over a decade. And they were asked, they were being asked on the spot to decide whether they were going to keep their jobs or go with a new startup law firm. At a point in time, I had offered them no concrete salary, benefits. We didn't have an office yet. We didn't have anything in place. And despite their, I think, allegiance to me personally, that was not strong enough to overcome that dilemma for them. And all of them made the decision that we're going to stay, which I don't blame them for at all. I mean, in their situation, I probably would have done the same thing. But what it told me is what I should have done. And if I wanted to keep my staff, what I needed to do, and I would encourage others to do, is before you tell your firm that you're leaving, you need to have a concrete plan and be able to offer anybody you want to bring with you specific details of what you're going to pay them, what benefits and compensation are, and give them security that you can offer that. Because otherwise, you may lose access to your key staff, which I did. And that was a really hard blow because staff is so critical to being able to run a successful law practice. And the value of those years of training and experience and our workflow that we had together, I couldn't replicate that with anybody else. So that was just really what I thought was a really potentially major setback. It turned out not to be as big a deal as I expected it would be, but at the moment, it was really, it created a lot of anxiety and worry on my part.
I can imagine.
And then the other thing was, despite my aforementioned comments of tamping down the emotion, it did become a little bit more acrimonious and bitter than I would have hoped. They were quite angry with me at my former firm. And just one example of that, this is kind of a funny but not so funny story, is, you know, keep in mind, this is a place that for 17 years I had gone to work every single day, spent countless hours in, had deep relationships with people at, you know, I thought I had been, had an instrumental role in really building the firm into what it was, recruiting a lot of the lawyers there. And I went back at one point just to basically say hi to some folks there. And I went back into the part of the office where my office used to be to say hi to my paralegal and legal assistant. And one of the lawyers who I'd been partners with and friends with for years came down and basically threatened to fight me in the office. I mean, got in my face, was like yelling at me, telling me to get out. You know, I wasn't allowed in that part of the office where the client files were, you know, stuff like that. And it was kind of at that point when I realized, this is really, this isn't great. And I left, you know, I didn't want to ratchet that up. But I think that that really illustrates the point that despite all the steps we took to make it fairly amicable and seamless and frictionless, there were really strong emotions still there that needed to be dealt with. I've since repaired my relationship with that lawyer, and I consider him a friend. And so that's in the past. But it was an eye-opening story. We joke about it now.
I can imagine. Next topic we said we were going to transition to was, how did you make a decision whether you needed a partner or not, and how did you go about choosing?
Yeah. So I'm the kind of person who I don't think I could have or would have ever done this without having somebody to do it with. I'm just not somebody who likes to be isolated at that level, and I need somebody to share that journey with. So to me, it was really a question of who, not whether. And so, and I think, so the who, not whether question is something that a lot of people will confront. To me, it was an obvious thing, but it wouldn't be necessarily for everyone. And I think when you're thinking about whether to have a partner or not, it is worth thinking through what it means to have a partner longer term, because we talked about the divorce analogy, and it would be similar to extricating yourself from a mess in a messy divorce and then marrying somebody else right away.
Immediately.
That's not always the best choice. So you really want to think through that carefully, because this is a relationship that you may have for years. And it, just like the one you're getting out of, it's going to have a lot of entanglements. Your financial lives will be entangled. Your personal lives will be entangled. There's going to be a lot there. So be careful about that is all I can say. And think carefully about who that person is if you want to have those entanglements. What are the downsides to having a partner? One is what I just said, that you have to navigate that personal relationship with a new spouse, if you will. Secondly, one reason I left my old firm was because I wanted to own and have control over a new practice that I could mold to my own personal vision. Well, if you have a partner, it's not 100% you anymore. So you're going to have to deal with somebody else's ideas and perspectives and make sure there's alignment on a vision, how you want to manage your law firm. And finally, just on a simple level, you're going to have to give up some of your equity. Instead of owning 100% of the business, you're going to own less of that. So, and as the business grows and the value of it increases, that equity has increasing value. So you're giving somebody an enormous amount of value in a business you're starting. So you should think through those issues. On the plus side, you add immediately to your capacity as a law firm, because instead of having one highly skilled lawyer, you have two or more if you have more partners. And you may need that depending on what kind of work you do and how many clients and cases you take. You may need capacity. Second, you bring in the reputation of that second lawyer that you're adding as a partner. So if they have a different sphere of influence, different relationships and contacts in the world, or a different practice area that you can tap into, you get the advantages of that. You also get the advantages of their experience and skill set. You get the emotional support of having a partner to go through a journey with you where there's going to be a lot of ups and downs. And it's really nice to be able to call somebody and commiserate with them or laugh when something funny happens or deal with challenging issues as they come up. So to me, those pros outweighed the cons, and I went with the choice to have a partner. And so some of my observations about that in having the partner is that when you start the new firm, we talked about this before, but there's going to be a period of time where you're in the wilderness and there's very little structure. So you're coming out of an environment, potentially, depending on where you've been before, where there's a lot of structure, there's a lot of support and a lot of certainty and predictability, and you're moving into an environment where there's none of any of those things. So if you have somebody, I mean, we all know personality types that just don't do well in unstructured environments. They can be very, very effective, say lawyers, if they have the support and structure in place. But if you take that away, they're lost. So I was really fortunate to have a partner who actually thrives without structure. And you know that from dealing with Taylor. I mean, that can be both a good and a bad thing. But in the early days of our practice, it was a very good thing, because he just starts doing. He doesn't think about, well, we need to have a system or structure in place. He just starts in on it, whatever it is. And at the beginning, that's just what you need. So, I mean, he was just on the phone every day, calling lawyers, looking for case referrals, building relationships, on the phone with places to like rent office space and get office furniture. And I mean, the furniture might have been a disaster, but he's getting shit done. Whereas I'm much more of a planner and a plotter. And so I can sometimes get in my own way, and you need that balance. I think in terms of a partner relationship, the most important piece in a partner is to have complementary skill sets where you can cover where your skill sets cover different areas that you need to have a successful business. The really downside of partnership, or where you run into problems, is where you and your partner have real weaknesses and they're both in the same areas. And so there are some areas I think both my partner and I do have weaknesses. For instance, I think financial planning and budgeting has been a weakness for both of us. And so recognizing that, I've always recognized the need in our firm to have strong financial controls, to have people that are highly competent in keeping the books and records and a budget and numbers. Because I just know for a fact, neither my partner or I are really good at that. We don't like it. It's not our forte. But I think in many areas, our skill sets are quite different. Taylor is much more of a fly by the seat of his pants kind of guy. He's more of a relational person, a processor. His problem solving approach is to just call people randomly at odd times of the day and night to throw ideas out there, many of which are half-baked and ill-conceived, but, you know, one out of every 10 is really valuable. He likes to talk through issues. I like to think. I like to write. I like to plan. I'm not necessarily a communicator like that. So it really helps me because, I mean, at the beginning of our practice, he'd call me like 12 times a day. I mean, including at like 1 in the morning or 12 at night. And you know, sending me emails at 2 a.m. and just kind of crazy stuff. But it forced me to kind of come out of my shell and engage on things a lot that maybe I wouldn't have otherwise. On the other hand, I don't think it would have been a good system to have a firm built by somebody who is primarily fly by the seat of their pants and not planning, and that our respective kind of value and roles have changed as our firm has grown as to be more of a managed practice. The things that worked really well in our first couple of years, you know, don't fly as well now. But at the end of the day, my partner's someone who I really like individually as a person. I also trust him inherently. I know he's a good person. I think he always has the best interests of our clients and our firm at heart. And I think you know that he's just a fundamentally very good human being. And so I think it's overall been a good partnership. I don't think any partnership is perfect. Ours certainly isn't, and there's always room for improvement. I think you need to constantly nurture that and also have processes in place to make that happen. Because otherwise, back to the divorce analogy, you know, you're going to go years without having real conversations about important issues to the point your partnership may be broken and unsalvageable. So you do have to be cognizant of that. I'm going to stop talking there and I want to turn it back to you because you've been here long enough now to see the workings of our firm and the partnership and you've gotten to know both me and Taylor a bit.
Take your playbook to the next level by joining a legal network of all-stars at psrplaybook.com. PSRPlaybook.com is a free digital legal library created exclusively for plaintiff lawyers by the nationally recognized personal injury law firm of Panish Shea Ravipudi LLP and features video content showcasing the tactics, strategies, and concepts implemented by some of the industry's most successful trial attorneys. PSRPlaybook.com promotes learning, shared knowledge, collaboration, and best practices. Get in the game and see for yourself by joining our national network of plaintiff lawyers. Subscribe now at psrplaybook.com and learn from the best.
What are your observations from more of an outsider's perspective on that?
On how the partnership's working?
Yeah.
I like the fact that you both have different styles, different ways to look at issues, different opinions. During our leadership teams, Taylor still sends, he sent an email at 1:38 in the morning the other day about something random. So he's still doing that, which is Taylor, and it's fantastic. I like it. And I've enjoyed watching the process of us trying to run this more as a business as opposed to just focusing on obviously the client and the attorney work, and you know, the evolution of seeing you and Taylor give up control. Because obviously when you started, you wore every hat. I mean, you were facilities, you were HR, you were marketing, you were the attorneys, you were probably your own paralegals and legal assistants, and slowly realizing that your time is spent better elsewhere. I think you've done a better job of that than Taylor. Taylor likes to hold on to some things that we still need to pry away from him, and he knows that. And we talk about it all the time. We're going to talk about it again this Thursday. And we have a lot of work to do, but I think you two complement each other well. And I can see why it's worked and why it will continue to work. One thing I wanted to talk about, and I don't want you to get into great detail, but I don't want us to ignore it, is probably the financial obligation of starting your own firm. Obviously, we don't have to talk particulars, but did you overestimate or underestimate actually what this was going to wind up costing you and Taylor to go out on your own? And were you shocked?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one that anybody who wants to start a firm needs to think about. So a lot of the answer to that is going to depend on where somebody is in their life when they embark on the process of starting a law firm. I think for somebody who's recently graduated from law school, who's still living in an apartment and eating ramen noodles and doesn't have a lot of obligations, you can start on a shoestring and really build up from there. And when you're 5 or 10 years in, you're going to have a really financially successful practice at the time when your cash flow needs individually, you know, family obligations come to require that. For me, I didn't have that luxury because I started this law firm when I was 50 years old, roughly, and I have 2 kids that I was currently putting through college and a third on the way to college and multiple mortgages to pay and all kinds of other stuff. So I knew I had, and I was earning a lot of money in my prior practice, so I was giving that up and planning to invest a substantial amount of cash in the new practice. So it needed to work, and it needed to work fast. So that was one of the big stressors for me. All of that said, I overestimated how much money it was going to cost. I had initially, and I don't mind just being specific about it because I think it'll help people. I initially put in $250,000 to help get us off the ground. My partner put in a little bit of money as well. And that was kind of our seed money. But I was committed by our agreement to put in double or triple that. I don't remember exactly, but another substantial chunk of capital, which I was more than prepared to do. But we never needed it because we, like I said, we brought over those 40 cases. We got right down to the business of monetizing those cases. And I mean, in our very first year, we had 7-figure fee revenue, and we always were generating more fee revenue than, you know, that we had enough to fund our business, to fund our additional case costs and continue to grow. So I feel very fortunate about that. But it was part of a plan, and it worked. We were able to start hitting the ground running by planting our flag in a very significant way, which was part of our game plan. And probably the next episode, we're going to get into vision, mission statement, vision, and for an initial launch of the firm. And we spent a bunch of time doing that. But I overestimated what the cash flow or actual cash out of pocket needs were, because we were fortunate to be able to have cases right away.
I was going to bet you'd say you underestimated.
I thought I was going to, that's where I would have been, but no, we weren't. I've never had to put in that extra cash, and that's all long past now. So
I bet there's attorneys out there listening, and one of their biggest trepidations about making the move is they may be in a similar situation to you, where there's always a reason not to do it. You have kids, you have mortgages, you have kids heading to college, your spouse probably thinks you're going through a midlife crisis, and why would you quit this great job and take a flyer at age 50 I think having family buy-in or the buy-in of your spouse or partner is probably one of the key things in order to make this work. It would have to be.
It is. And I have to say my wife, Sarah, supported me 100%. I mean, I think she saw my angst and frustration with my former firm. She's always supported any of my professional choices and wanting to be there for me. However, the timing of it was a little bit questionable because at the moment I moved out of my old firm to start this new one, my wife was the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate in Maine, fighting a very hotly contested Senate race and completely focused on that 100% of the time. So in addition, we were in the middle of the pandemic. So we had, you know, like a lot of people, kids at home that were trying to do their school from home computers and Zoom, a lot of dislocations and anxieties from a pandemic, questions of economic downturns, wife's Senate campaign. So
you chose the absolute worst time possible.
One might have questioned the timing of it. However, I do think that there's been a lot written about it, but a lot of very successful businesses start in economic downturns or at points in time when it's actually more challenging to start a business. And I think in our case, I think that it helped our business enormously actually to start in the middle of the pandemic because it forced us to run the business better. While other law firms had people working remotely from home, we insisted that everybody come into the office every day when we started our firm. And for 2+ years, everybody did. Everybody had they were socially distanced in their own office spaces. But while other firms were kind of mailing it in, we were working hard and making up ground. Also, courts were closed. So our competitors weren't out there trying cases and getting verdicts. Nobody could do that. So we weren't losing ground there either. So I feel like there were a lot of ways. And then with the pandemic came remote depositions. So rather than having to spend the money to travel all over the country like I used to do depositions, which took me out of the state, was highly unproductive and also costly, we were able to stay home, take all those depositions remotely, save the cost, and then have extra time that we could spend building our firm. So it actually worked really well for us to start the firm when we did, other than the stress it put on the family with the Senate campaign and all that. I just want to mention one other thing about the partner, and we can move on to our final topic, which is, you know, it's worth pointing out that my partner, Taylor, is 12 years behind me in terms of his legal career. So although we're partners, we are at very different places kind of in our, you know, he's got young kids now, whereas mine are in college. He was an associate at our former firm, hadn't made partner there yet, which meant I could bring him in as a partner, but our share of the profits was highly disproportionate toward me early on, with a plan that would gradually even out over time. And so that was another way that I was able to ensure that I could have the revenue I needed to support myself. Even in year one, as a very small equity participant, my partner earned substantially more money than he made as an associate in our former practice, and I made less. So it worked out well for him, but it was structured in a way that allowed me to make it work. So that's another consideration. You know, if you had two partners that were equal seniority, you know, same age, same vintage, you wouldn't be able to necessarily do it that way.
No, it's a good point. So you've left the firm, you've chosen a partner, all your staff stayed. What was your next step, especially from a staffing standpoint and losing all that infrastructure?
Yeah, so this is the final topic for today, is how do you staff up your new law firm? There is nothing more shocking when you leave someplace that has all the support and infrastructure that you come to rely upon and need every day and recognize you don't have any of that anymore. It's a really scary thing because you go from just showing up and doing your job and representing your clients to nothing else is going to get done. There's nobody to make copies. There's nobody to turn the lights on. There's nobody to clean the conference room when you've made a mess having your DoorDash lunch there. There's nobody to do anything for you. And now, and you've got 40 cases that you're responsible for handling these. And so figuring that out quickly is really critical. and you have to prioritize. You can't do everything at once, right? I mean, you want to have a chief operating officer, you want to have a marketing director, you want to have a HR person. I don't know what you want. You cannot have probably any of those things right away. What you need are to have the minimal critical staff that can allow you to keep the lights on, service your clients, and run the business until you can generate enough revenue to hire the next person, the next person, the next person. So for my kind of business, what we needed was a paralegal with knowledge and experience who could handle all of the back office responsibilities for the cases we still had and we had to manage, and could do that right away without enormous amounts of hand-holding, supervision, and training. We didn't have time to do that. So we were very fortunate that at the same time we left our firm, although none of my staff left with me as I had expected, another paralegal from our firm who had a decade of experience herself working for one of the top medical malpractice lawyers in our state also left the firm, and she agreed to come with us. And that was just incredibly important to our new practice. So initially it was my partner, myself, and our one paralegal. But that paralegal had enough experience and skill that she could handle the day-to-day tasks, and that for free as long as you sign up to have them do your SEO marketing. And that can be done at a reasonable cost.
We've lost spent.
In terms of coming up with graphics for branding and for other industry ads and other marketing, for a period of time, we relied on gig providers such as Fiverr or Upwork. We would find people who could do discrete projects for us, send it out to them. They would get them done in 48 hours. Sometimes you have multiple or unlimited revisions that come with that. It's very inexpensive. Many of those people did great work for us. Bookkeeping, something else that can be outsourced, not a core function necessarily. And if you find somebody you can trust and rely upon to do that, it's a good thing to outsource. My old law firm, we used to have all of our legal assistants would do a lot of transcriptions of dictation and letter creation and all that. We outsourced all that. That has worked extremely well for us. If I dictate a letter or a memo, even if it's a lengthy one, it goes out, comes back into our office, usually in less than an hour, saves our legal assistants and paralegals time. They don't need to do that. And it's relatively inexpensive to do that. Medical records requests, that's something that we had attempted to outsource. It was a dismal failure. We then insourced it by hiring a medical records clerk to do that. That worked extremely well, but it was costly and a thankless job that nobody really wants to do long term. So there's high burnout. And then we found a way to outsource it again, and it's working quite well for us. So those are just some examples. There's many different areas of things you can find to outsource that are going to be effective and allow you to scale up and take burdens off of your staff so that the limited staff you have early on can focus on those client services side of the business and the workflow and processing your cases, you know, no matter what kind of law you're doing, so that you can charge your hourly rate fee or obtain your contingent fee if you're in my kind of business. And then we have built that out gradually. So starting with the principle of what's the minimum critical staff you need to manage the work and meet your ethical and legal obligations to your clients. And obviously, hopefully do great work, because that's why people are going to hire you and you're going to continue to do that great work. Then you're gradually going to build that out over time to supplement that core staff that does the client services side of it. And then eventually have the luxury of hiring some people to provide some additional administrative support on top of that. That goes beyond the topic that I wanted to cover today, though. That's more of a build out. So yeah, that's kind of...
I think we covered everything.
That's my take on initial staffing.
Yeah. Amazingly, we got through all three of those in a lot of time. A little over.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff, I feel like I'm talking too much and not giving you enough, but what's you weren't here in those early right. days, but I guess, can you envision how that evolves, or what, I guess in most of your jobs in the banking sector, you're in organizations that have quite a bit of staffing and infrastructure.
Yeah. I mean, this is the smallest organization I've ever worked for in terms of, you know, number of employees. And I can envision what that involves. And it's something that I think people listening to this, I think a lot of people would want to do what you've done, but I don't think everyone is capable of doing it. I mean, me personally, to be able to take that leap of faith, have that faith in myself to know it's going to work and to leave that amount of stability for the unknown, I do not think is for everybody. And I think that's probably the first decision everyone has to make is, are they willing to take that leap of faith and have that entrepreneurial spirit, like you said, to make it happen?
Yeah. And your vision of it is, well, I'm going to be kind of the man running this business and being able to do all these cool, fun things that I want to do. I've always wanted to do. I see flaws in the business I'm in. I think I can do it better. But when you start out, you're just trying to figure out, how do we find someone who can clean the bathroom? I mean, literally. And as you know, that's been a big challenge.
It has been a big challenge. It's a challenge this week.
Yes, it was. Ongoing, or supply toilet paper, for example.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, you forget about those kind of things when it's all done for you for many, many years. But it's gratifying once you can get over that hurdle and start to see it all come together. So we look forward to our future conversations where we move on from here.
Absolutely.
As we've said, anybody who has questions, topics, or things they want to add to the contribute to the conversation, please reach out to either of us and we'll look forward to seeing you next time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Jeff.
Have a good one, everyone.
Did we rise to the challenge today? If so, tell a friend. If not, tell us what would make the podcast more valuable to you. Thanks for spending your valuable time with us today. And remember, when we elevate people and we elevate practices, we elevate the profession. Produced and powered by LawPods.